This is a Squiz podcast. We're your shortcut to being informed.
This week, our podcast is brought to you by the Australian Government. From the 1st of July this year, every Australian taxpayer will receive a tax cut. You can use the tax cut calculator at taxcuts.gov.au to estimate your annual tax cut and see what it means for you.
Hi, it's Claire Kimball, and News Club is the place to go for conversations about the news. This week, there's going to be plenty of coverage on the budget, what it means for you, what it means for the economy. So we thought it would be a really good time to dive into the process of how a budget gets made and also how the media reports on it. This week's News Club is an interview with James Chessel. He's a Walkley award-winning journalist. He's the former managing director of Nine Publishing, which means that he oversaw the mastheads, the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age, and the Australian Financial Review. He also spent time as a staffer in politics, which makes him uniquely qualified on this topic. He talks about how the budget has changed over the years. He also gets into the changing coverage of a budget, and also the bingo words to look out for this year. James, before we get started about all things federal budget, what drew you out of journalism to the very bright lights of Parliament House back in 2006?
Well, I grew up in Canberra. My father was a public servant for a long period of time. My mum was a public servant for a long period of time. I watched all the television shows that people who become staffers watch. I read all the books. An opportunity came up and I thought, if I don't do it now, I'll probably miss the chance. I can tell you that it is, and you know, Claire, but it is nothing like the television shows and nothing like the books.
Just as glamorous, isn't it?
Slightly less, slightly less glamorous. And it's just like no one needs to feel sorry for us. We chose to do it. And on one level, it was very enjoyable, but it is a grind. A lot of it is answering phone calls from journalists, mostly asking pretty reasonable questions and not having particularly good answers to those questions, depending on your point in the political cycle.
Indeed, and you were right at the pointy end of the very pointy ends of the Howard government years. So just with that hat on, tell us how the government, I guess, gets the ball rolling on a budget. Let's tackle that. How far out does it start?
It's a really good question. I mean, I would say in the modern political environment, the budget process never really ends. A bit like we now say the news cycle never really ends. There's no break. But if you were sort of taking the traditional approach, you'd say around September and October, budget planning begins. Probably between December and February, you're developing and costing policy proposals if you're in a department or a minister's office. And then in February and April, the rubber hits the road.
So that's when the decisions about what's going to be in it get made. And it has a lot to do with something called the Expenditure Review Committee, which is a group that sits within the government's cabinet. Can you just explain that a bit?
So rather than having the entire cabinet consider it, the ERC is a segment of the cabinet, and it will look at each of those proposals and say to the minister, change, we're not doing it, or yes. And anything the ERC wants to do needs to be endorsed by the cabinet at the end of the day, but it is a way of the prime minister concentrating power within a few smaller number of people, partly for political reasons and partly for efficiency reasons. And they're the ones that I do remember, and I you know, it was always a big moment when a minister had to trot off to the ERC with a cap in hand and ask for money.
And pretty bruising, some of those meetings as well. I guess it's easy to think from the outside that there's, you know, sort of one pen on some of these things, that there's this very cohesive sort of approach and the Prime Minister is sitting there and saying, this is what we're going to do. But of course, there's a lot of personalities that come together in the cabinet and then, as you say, in those committees.
Exactly. And so it is not always a unified approach. Ministers will obviously, like in any group of people, try and play each other off against each other. And sometimes they will know that I'm not going to get proposal A if Claire over there gets proposal B.
Yeah,
so
and deals and wheeling and dealing.
Exactly. Yeah. So it is obviously a process where there is a lot of economic analysis and financial analysis applied to the ideas, but there is also a political analysis. And I think it's also really important to any treasurer and prime minister also is sitting there going, how many budgets am I out from an election, for example? Do I need to get some tougher economic policies out of the way now because we've got an election coming up and I want to be a little bit more generous at that point of time? Also, global economic events may be happening. There's a lot of unease about the situation in the Middle East, for example. And so that political and global kind of economic overlay have as much influence on the way the budget is shaped as anything else.
So you've got the politics that are playing out. You've got a broader environment, a broader economic environment to take account of. You've got electoral cycles. And then you've got the departments and how they actually help this process and come up against politics. It's a real discussion about bureaucracy and politics and how they work together.
It's really good that you brought that up because it is the final piece of the budget puzzle. I said before, my dad was a public servant. He worked in Treasury. He started in 1970, and he told me that in 1970, the Treasurer's staff consisted of someone who answered the phones, a press secretary, and a parliamentary liaison officer. So it's three people in his office.
And these days it's
more than 20 people in Jim Chalmers, the current treasurer's office. So there's been a huge change. Obviously in 1970, if you've got that few staff in your office, you are almost wholly dependent on your department for not just doing the work, but the economic advice. So the relationship back then is going to be a lot closer and a lot more codependent. Whereas now with ministerial offices chock full of advisors, they rely less on the department and you're more likely to get a process-focused public service rather than one that's trying to push the reform agenda. And I think, and this is not a political statement, it applies to both sides. I think everyone would agree we could have had a bit more reform over the last couple of decades.
That's what everyone is saying.
So that's a really long-winded answer to your question, but it's such a critical issue and it's at the heart of everything.
And while this budget process is going on, the government's also trying to land things ahead of the date, to set some expectations. A lot of that has to do with managing the media side of things.
The other thing that's happening concurrently in the weeks leading up to the budget is that the Treasurer is giving speeches. The Treasurer is attending events like Jim Chalmers did in the US. There was an IMF meeting and he obviously met with global finance ministers. The Treasurer's office is leaking stories to the media, and all of that is an attempt to frame the budget narrative. It's a terrible political expression. but
James, just quickly, you mentioned leaking there. What kind of information do governments leak in the lead up to the budget?
Governments leak stories, whether they're to do with the budget or anything else, because in the hope that they'll get more favourable coverage than they would if they just announced it to everyone at exactly the same time. So if you go to a handpicked journalist and you say, listen, there's going to be some tax cuts in the budget, this is what they look like, it's a reasonable bet that that journalist is going to write it up relatively uncritically, certainly on day one. And look, there's a big debate about the efficacy of that and whether journos should accept leaks and whether journos shouldn't accept leaks. And some editors, my ex-colleague Gay Alcorn, who was until recently the editor of The Age, was very much against it. Other editors say it's just part of the process and all policies end up being critically analysed. But that's why governments do it. More specifically for the budget, they will drop stories, and that's sort of the expression. You drop the story with newspaper X or television station Y because they want to get that positive coverage, and they also want to frame the budget. They want to sort of tell the story of the budget before the speech. So it gives them a bunch of different goes at selling the budget.
A bit more of a runway.
Exactly right.
Before I get you to put your editor and journalist hat on, despite those leaks, the budget papers are kept under pretty strict security. Just explain why that is.
Well, it's the most important policy or set of policies the government will announce every year. So it's important that it's not announced willy-nilly, although they do leak a fair amount of it.
Yeah.
And there is a famous time when Laurie Oakes, the Nine journalist, got his hand on the budget papers the day before the budget and was able to print a lot of it, which was, absolutely amazing. but the other thing is a lot of what the Treasurer will announce has the ability to move markets, direct impact on businesses and other organisations. So, there does need to be some rigour and confidence that it will be handled in an appropriate way.
So here we are at budget day. What does the day actually look like?
So what the government will do is any journalist who wants to cover the budget will go into something called the budget lockup, which is a bunch of rooms in Parliament House that are effectively sealed off for a number of hours. They're given the budget papers early. And the idea behind that is that they then, when they emerge bleary-eyed and
into the light
later in the day, they're able to write or speak more coherently about the budget because they've had time to digest it.
Yeah. So just explain that whole process a little bit with your journalist hat on. You come into a room, you're literally locked in.
You're on a separate system. You cannot, your phone's been taken away from you. You are completely sealed off.
Away you go.
In an economic oasis.
And you have people from the departments there?
Yeah, you have there's a few groups of people. You have people from the department who are trying to be helpful and explain things. So you might have questions about how this number was arrived at. Why is the iron ore forecast here and not there?
Yeah.
They will try and give you, I'm generalising here, but factual answers to that.
Yeah.
You will have the treasurer walk through and they will give you some political spin, and you also sometimes have interest groups people in there who are looking at it from various industry bodies. So they're often good sounding boards. You know, they often have vested interests, but they're also looking at it, and they want to be in the lockup for the same reasons the journalists do, which is to get an advanced copy and be able to have something interesting to say the moment the lockup ends, because there is a bit of a frenzy at that point.
Yeah,
where everyone wants to get their information out.
I'm curious about how the 24-hour news cycle has changed that media frenzy.
So the lockup ends, the stories are moved onto a live system.
Yeah.
And then they're published. And obviously in the 70s when my dad was doing it, it was all based around a newspaper audience and a little bit of television and radio. Now it's mainly framed around an online audience. Television is still very important. The way in which the Treasurer is able to deal with the 7:30 interview has almost become, for many insiders, more interesting than the budget speech itself, because it's normally a leading indicator of how well the Treasurer is across the message.
Yeah.
And then the Treasurer will go out in the days following the budget and try and, I mentioned the word narrative, but try and make sure the narrative doesn't get off course for the government.
And look, in your former role as the editor of coverage, what are you looking for when you're pulling together the front page for the next day or to go up online instantly? What are you trying to curate, I guess?
Well, the big change that occurred when I was around, and look, there were a lot of other people who were executing it, had better ideas, so I don't want to pretend this was me, but it was the switch from, if you're working at a masthead like the AFR or the Australian or the Sydney Morning Herald, was the switch in focus from the print side of things to digital. Now, that shouldn't be a surprise to anyone who follows media even loosely, but the online audiences are growing. The print audiences are still important, but they're shrinking over time. So by definition, you're going to focus more on the online side of things. One of the interesting things for all newsrooms is that as you start focusing more on online, you get a lot more data about your audience and you actually have a much better idea of what your audience does and doesn't want to read. And to be very honest, you learn that the benefits of putting out 20, 30-page print wraps around a newspaper probably aren't justified, to be very frank. There is good interest in budgets among readers. And obviously, if you're at the Financial Review, you know, you've got a more specialist audience and they're going to be very, very interested in its coverage. But for a general audience, the stories that tend to do really, really well are, you know, those scorecards of like, what's in it for me? When you're talking about infrastructure policy in regional Victoria for a general audience, I'm not saying that is obviously very clearly
there's an audience for that.
But you're slicing and dicing it so much to fill those big print products that I think in some way they've become a bit of a symbolic gesture of by newspapers to show that they're really, really interested in the subject, as they should be.
And giving it the due attention that a big thing like that needs.
There's always an element of that in journalism. It's like, this is a big story. We're going to dress it up because it deserves to be. But, you know, you realise that for the average reader, it's an important story, but it's not the be-all and end-all.
It feels like audience tastes are really changing. If they were changing before, they feel like they're on hyperspeed.
Well, I don't think they're changing. I think we just know more about it now.
Yeah, right. So you think they were always just going straight to the version of what's in it for me, even though there were 30-odd pages of coverage?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're reading a handful of stories. Yeah. They're not reading all of the stories. Now, obviously, if you put out a newspaper, you know there aren't many people who are going to read every single story in it. But the paper side of it is deliberate overkill. They know that the front pages will be put up on all the morning TV shows. There's great competition between the newspaper editors to come up with the best cartoon.
Yes,
it's one of the few days of the year you get to put a picture on the front rather than a photograph.
Yeah.
And everyone spends a lot of time, often before the budget, coming up with, you know, their creative idea, visual idea to express the key themes of the budget. And most editors will go in with 1, 2, 3 already half-formed ideas.
Yeah.
And they will adjust it depending on what the treasurer unveils on the day. But it'd be very rare for them to go in with a complete blank piece of paper. They have an idea about what they like and what they don't like about the budget already, and they want to kind of portray that. And they've got their artists in there and they're talking to them. And it's a really fascinating process. But that's the beauty of newspapers. You can over-egg it a bit on those days, and you know, it doesn't hurt anyone's feelings if there's a few extra stories in there that don't need to be.
If the journalists were under pressure, I can't imagine the pressure a cartoonist.
But the story of covering the budget is obviously very closely linked to how media is changing.
Yeah.
And you know, both those things are developing as the years go by.
The budget that we're coming into, it could be the last before the federal election. Splashing cash around is a bit of a thing as you're heading into an election, as you were talking about before, and setting things up so that you can start this a narrative that you were talking about as you're heading into an election campaign. What are you expecting this budget?
I think they have given all the indications that they will spend a little bit of money, so I don't think it's going to be a particularly severe or austere budget. You know, the previous budgets have all been about inflation and what we can do to manage that and get it down to the Reserve Bank's goal of between 2% and 3%. Inflation will still be part of the conversation, but I think there will be a little bit more talk about about growth and ambition, and that will involve a little bit of government spending. And that's where the political tension comes in. So you'll have the opposition saying, well, is it responsible for the government to be spending money at the moment when inflation is not completely and utterly under control? But your point about the next election, and we talked about this earlier, is absolutely critical. No government in the history of the universe is sitting there going, we're just going to deliver the budget completely on its own merits. They're looking at it through a political lens. And the timing of the next election, which they probably don't know exactly, in fact, they almost definitely don't know exactly, will play a part in shaping the budget.
Final question. It's a really tough one. I like playing budget bingo. So you get your little spreadsheet of all the political terms, the two-liners, the two-word liners, all of those. What's the phrase that you're looking out for this year?
I've mentioned a couple of them. Global headwinds or global tensions, if I could put them both in the same basket.
You can have both of them.
That's a safe one.
Yep.
An even safer bet, cost of living pressure.
Okay.
Cost of living.
That's been a bit of a favourite of recent times.
Look, it's not a particularly original answer. I admit it's something that tends to come up regardless of the treasurer. And then I think there'll be a lot of talk about strengthening the economy as well, given the uncertainty in places like the Middle East. So the treasurer will try to have a sort of a sense of where we're building for the future, we're strengthening the economy. So I think that would be my third pick.
Good tips. Thanks for that. Thanks, James.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of News Club. Larissa will be back with Kate for the weekly wrap on Saturday, and I'll be back next week.